special episode is a workshop entitled Introducing the Green Socialist Organizing Project and was presented at the 2021 Green Party US Annual National Meeting.
Okay, hello everyone. Welcome and thank you for joining us this afternoon. This workshop is Introducing the Green Socialist Organizing Project. Our presenters today are Helly Hawkins and Michael Rubin. So without further ado, you may begin. I guess I'll pass the Zoom mic to Howie.
Thank you, Diane. Yeah, I'm gonna make a presentation and Michael is, and we're gonna have question and answers. The idea of the Green Socialist Organizing Project was coming out of the campaign that Angela Walker and I ran. We wanted to continue advancing the eco-socialist program that we campaigned on. So we've been doing that through our candidate committee, but we found out from the FEC we've got to set up something separate. So we're in the process of doing that in terms of organizational form. You know, it'll be some kind of nonprofit, a 501c4 or unincorporated association. But we've been meeting, had probably four or five, you know, meetings of people interested, and have set up some working groups that I'll talk about. But let me first talk about what are these ideas that we want to continue advancing. You know, Angela and I had three basic themes that we were campaigning on: an eco-socialist Green New Deal, an economic Bill of Rights, which we'd always included in the Green New Deal, but it dealt with the growing crisis of inequality and how inequality kills. And then we have the peace and disarmament theme with this new nuclear arms race and US wars all over the world. And now post-election, we have a democracy crisis. So if I was running again, that would be a fourth theme. So the eco-socialist Green New Deal was saying, we gotta do like the United States did during World War II, when the federal government took over a quarter of the manufacturing capacity of the country, in order to turn industry on a dime into the arsenal of democracy, in order to arm the allies against the Axis powers. You couldn't do that through incentives to corporations in the market. You had to take ownership and plan that production. And we need to do nothing less to deal with this climate crisis. So what's the situation now? The progressive Democrats are pushing spending more than Biden's willing to spend on basically a Keynesian Green New Deal, which is tax breaks and contracts for corporations in the market. It's uncoordinated and it won't even happen if they can't make a profit. So it's not what we need to get the changes we need. 100% green power and zero greenhouse emissions, moving toward negative emissions, because we're past James Hansen's safety point of 350 parts per million carbon in the atmosphere. We're at about 420 parts carbon in the atmosphere. We haven't been there in 5 million years, when the temperatures were much higher than today. The sea level was much higher. I mean, it'll be a disaster. So more than ever, we need to get this idea of a eco-socialist Green New Deal out there. You know, the progressive Democrats, the Thrive Agenda, which all the sort of liberal progressive environmental groups are pushing, they're pushing what Biden is pushing. And they're not even dealing with the technological problems. This latest $3.5 trillion proposal, which isn't gonna pass at that size probably, all they wanna do is swap out internal combustion engines for electric vehicles, but keep us dependent on individual car transportation and freight by trucks. We can't afford the resources, the cobalt, the lithium, all that copper. It's gonna be an environmental disaster in itself. That's why we need a planning, you know, social ownership and planning, so we can integrate transportation, mass transit, with redesigning our cities around walkable, bikeable communities. So we're using them much more efficiently, our resources and energy. That's what we gotta be talking about. And you know, one of the goals of this project is to try to get that into the debate. And I have to say that most of the eco-socialist groups out there during the campaign backed the Thrive agenda, backed the Progressive Democrats agenda, and said, vote for Biden. And what do we got now? We don't have a climate plan. Even in this $3.5 trillion plan that just came out, very little of it is directed toward climate, and a lot of it is misdirected. Like with the auto thing, the retrofitting of homes, you know, they want to do 2 million in 8 years. There are 120 million buildings in this country. You do the math, it's 480 years before we retrofit our building stock in this country. That is not a serious plan. So I think we have a contribution to make there. So that's one thing. And in the economic bill of rights, you know, we're talking about a job guarantee, a guaranteed income above poverty, Medicare for all, affordable housing guarantee, lifelong public education from pre-K through college, and secure retirement by increasing Social Security benefits. None of that, except in small parts, is in the Biden American Families Plan. And a lot of it's in this $3.5 trillion proposal that just came out. But it's hit or miss. I mean, they're bragging today about the child tax credit that only lasts a year, and it says it'll reduce child poverty in half. Why only half? So, you know, inequality kills. We've had growing or declining life expectancies even before the COVID pandemic hit, which knocked it down another notch, because so many working class people in the bottom 50% of the income spectrum, average annual income is $18,000 a year. That's poverty. They're not making ends meet, and we don't have a program to deal with them. So inequality is probably the first thing half our people are thinking about. You know, they know the climate is a problem, but first they're thinking, how am I going to pay the rent, my utility bill, put food on the table? And we don't have programs for that. So this economic bill of rights was the second thing. And then peace and disarmament. You know, I kept saying it, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists has the doomsday clock, the closest it's ever been to midnight, because of climate change, because of this nuclear modernization that the US kind of initiated, but China and Russia are following. They're making strategic missiles hypersonic, six times faster than the old ones. So launch on warning is no longer what you do. You launch on anticipation. And then at least Russia and the United States has this crazy crackpot doctrine that we're gonna escalate to de-escalate with tactical nukes and conventional wars. And as Daniel Ellsberg pointed out in his second Pentagon Papers, the doomsday machine, once one nuke flies, it's automated. They're all gonna fly, and that's the end of us. And then in terms of foreign policy, imperialism has not skipped a beat from Obama to Trump to Biden. And we've seen that in the US back in this guy that just got assassinated in Haiti, even though his term of office was up. They're still back in Guaido to take over Venezuela. We don't know what the hell they're doing in Peru. We still have about a dozen wars in which we have combat troops, special ops in over 100 countries. And the military budget was increased in Biden's budget proposal. So that's a whole nother existential crisis that we need to be speaking out on. And then I mentioned the democracy crisis. I mean, I just put out a news release blasting Biden for not addressing the filibuster the day before yesterday in a civil rights speech in Philadelphia. I mean, how could he do that if they don't at least reform it to get civil rights passed, voting rights passed? It's not going to happen. And it's not going to happen because the Democrats, the feckless Democrats, are getting rolled by the ruthless Republicans who are out there in the states using partisan gerrymandering in the 30 states they control to basically get themselves overrepresented. Example I like to point to is Wisconsin. Because of the 2010 gerrymandering the Republicans did, in the last election, Democrats got 54% of the assembly vote statewide, but only 38% of the seats because of gerrymandering. Most of the experts say in the House, after the gerrymandering is done, the Republicans are gonna gain 15 to 20 seats just because of gerrymandering they're working on right now. Democrats only have a 4-seat margin. So from that alone, the Republicans are gonna take back the House. So whatever Biden wanted to do, he's not getting done because he won't take on a filibuster. He'll never get done after that election. And then they're out there Everybody knows about the voter suppression laws they're doing, making it harder for people to vote. What's even more dangerous is they're disempowering independent elected secretaries of state and local boards of election. So the Republican legislatures can basically change election results. And they're going to steal elections. They're already removing Black Democrats from county boards of election in Georgia. And Raffensperger lost all his power to the legislature down there in Georgia. They're doing that in Florida, Texas, Arizona. So we got a situation where the Republicans are already taking advantage of the counter-majoritarian institutions we do have, like the U.S. Senate and the Electoral College and this partisan gerrymandering, and they're enhancing that so they can rule as a minority. And for us, it's even worse because the Republicans are no longer a conservative party. They're an extremist, racist, autocratic party, doesn't care about fair elections. And so when we get in elections, progressive-minded people are saying, we got to vote for the Democrats to stop these crazy Republicans. So it's going to be even harder for us going forward. So what I've been writing about and putting out there, and I think one of the things hopefully this Green Social Project can do as well, is we got to expand the pro-democracy agenda. Everybody sees what the Republicans are doing. What they don't see is what the Democrats do. They practice party suppression, which is what autocratic regimes do. We saw them do that. We got knocked off the ballot in three states by basically Democratic hack judges because the law and the facts were not on their side. But in Wisconsin, Montana, and Pennsylvania, we got knocked off the ballot. And that's the Democrats. So we got to challenge them for fair ballot access and also proportional representation. Think about it. Our single member district, winner take all system with plurality voting means that most people don't have representation because most of those districts are one party districts. 90% of House districts and 95% of state legislative districts are uncompetitive. That's why the non-voters win most elections. Why bother? We already know who's going to win. And most of us, it's not just Greens and Libertarians and Independents, it's the major party that's the minor party in that district. They never get their people represented. I mean, I've got as much as 48% running for a district seat here in Syracuse. Greens got no representation. It's Democrats control the city council. How is that democratic? It's just a more sophisticated form of one-party rule with two brands. And that's what we got to challenge the Democrats on. And what I said in that release was, Green candidates should be out there saying, our Democratic opponents should sign on to fair ballot access law and proportional representation. And if they don't, we're pulling their progressive card because they're autocrats. So anyway, those are the kind of issues that, you know, Anza and I were raising, the democracy crisis. You know, we raised ranked choice voting and we wanted a national ranked choice vote for president instead of that damn electoral college. We're out of 19 of the 50 presidents been elected since we counted the popular vote first in 1824. One with the plurality, five of them won with the minority that came in second, like Trump. It's crazy. It's a farce. So we've got to put these issues on the agenda. So coming back to the Green Social Organizing Project as an organization, we want to be a resource, not a faction in the Green Party. We want to provide useful materials and help to local and state Green parties that are organizing, to the eco-socialists or Green Socialists out there that want to educate. So, you know, it's not about taking over the steering committee or the national committee or state parties. It's about getting these ideas in the minds and hearts of grassroots Greens. And then, you know, how we're organized can take care of itself. So through our meetings, we've sort of come up with three working groups. One is education. And if you go to greensocialists.net, you can see some of the materials that are up already. So we're developing written and video materials, reading lists for study groups, how to do study groups, those kind of things. We have another working group on issues, which is developing or has developed a couple of position papers, one on ranked choice voting and proportional representation, one on the debt crisis and how capitalism now depends on debt and more extracting money from us through debt than they do from actually exploiting us in production. because for a lot of reasons, capitalism is stagnant and there are not so many opportunities to invest in the real economy. So they're squeezing us in other ways. And then, you know, part of what the Issues Working Group is talk about, you know, strategic orientation. We're too small to, you know, do national mobilizations, although we can contribute to that. But what should we prioritize? And one thing I think we've agreed is that there's a real movement out here now for ranked choice voting. I mean, I just read several cities are now considering it since the election, where we got five more cities in the state of Alaska, Burlington, Vermont, Austin, Texas, 23 cities and towns in Utah, several cities in Colorado. And I just read this last night, I'm trying to remember what cities, Kings County in Washington. I can't remember the others, but there are campaigns in about 45 states. So one thing in the Issues Working Group has talked about is making that a priority. And some of you, I hope, have received the messages I've been putting out to people about meetings in their states so they can get involved in these campaigns. And then the third working group is party building. And we've agreed that we want to do a manual on local party building, you know, the real practical, what you got to do. Same thing, another manual on local election campaigns. And then we're trying to figure out how we can be a resource for local and state parties. You know, we all know some of our parties have conflicts and internal problems. How do you resolve those democratically? And then the bigger question, I think, is how do we build our base? How do we go beyond the usual suspects? And actually, I'll be speaking on that in the workshop on local party building later this afternoon. But the, you know, the thing I've been emphasizing is we got to do what they call deep canvassing or relational organizing. And that is go out and talk to people, not preaching, but listening and finding out what their concerns are and then relating what they talk about to our program and do that on a consistent basis. I mean, have a real conversation. This is not the get out the vote election canvassing where you find out where people stand so you can, you know, pull them to the polls on election day, but building relationships so people get to know us, trust us, see us in activity. And, you know, that's a way we can build beyond the base we have now. Because if we're going to change this society, we got to be a mass party. We got to be in many more neighborhoods than we are. And so how do you do that kind of organizing? So that's what party building is trying to tackle. So if that sounds interesting, and Michael's going to talk about this more, and I'll say this again, but greensocialist.net, you can sign up to be informed when we meet. We've adopted some principles and activities called what we believe and what we do. You can read that. It's very succinct. And as I said, we're trying to figure out, basically, we got to set up another bank account from my candidate committee, which, by the way, we rolled over into the next election cycle. I am not a candidate for president. I'm not a candidate for president. We're just trying to keep going on these politics and cross that bridge after the midterms. So that's about what I have to say to introduce. And Michael, why don't you take it from there?
Thank you. Let me, before I start, let me introduce myself. I'm not nearly as well known as you are. So my name is Michael Rubin and I live in Oakland, California. And I've been a member of the Green Party since 2003, roughly. And I currently serve on the, what we call the County Council, which other people would call the County Central Committee of Alameda County, where I live, the party, of the Green Party. And I've been a political activist since the 1960s. So I have some experience in various things over the years. But let me say there's two parts to what I want to say. One of them is why eco-socialism? That is, and the other part is why, what would it mean to our party to become an eco-socialist party? What kind of changes might we expect and I'd like to talk about that as well. Well, let me start with what is eco-socialism. I mean, the basic tenet of eco-socialism and of socialism of any kind, but eco-socialism in particular, is that capitalism cannot be reformed, that we can make changes in it, we can limit some of the damage, but the fact is that we cannot have the kind of world that our 10 key values demand under capitalism. The evils of capitalism predate the Green Party by many, many years. It goes back to the founding of this country, in my opinion. The destruction of the indigenous people of America, and the, of course, the import of slavery and the start of slavery is both being essential ingredients that still haunt us today as we talk about the problems of America today. We can talk about those things still. And that tells me that capitalism has not addressed or even not much less solved the questions that slavery and the slaughter of the indigenous people of our country raised. So capitalism cannot be reformed. That's the number one thing I want to say. I think that the question of eco-socialism, well, let me go back. The fact that the problems of our country go all the way back to its founding means to me that we must have an honest assessment of that history, and until that becomes part of the general political life of a country, of our country, we're not going to get where we need to go. I have been influenced to some extent by critical race theory, and I think that things need to be said and addressed before we're going to make substantial progress. The other thing is, Trump was defeated, but Trumpism is still very much alive in our country. Trumpism is a serious matter, and the Democrats are not really addressing Trumpism. They are ignoring it, essentially. And that I think that we need to talk to figure out a way to relate to the 76 million people who voted for Trump in 2020. I mean, that's a big chunk of people. And we need to do something. We can't just let that remain. Now, the other thing is, eco-socialism. Now, the other part about why eco-socialism is the fact that eco-socialism is compatible as a compatible way way of giving life to the 10 key values of our party. And I think that we should be talking about that. I think that we need to talk about eco-socialism more directly in our party. And I hope that that's something that the Green Socialist Organizing Project will take up as we go along. Let me say a word about what does this mean for our party today and going forward. First, because of Bernie Sanders, socialism has become, has gained a foothold in the popular imagination, in the popular discourse. And I think that that's one thing that we need to take advantage of. Several years ago, the national platform was amended and our party became officially an anti-capitalist party. And I think that was a great thing, but only a partial thing. There's lots more to do around that inside our party. So one of the things that this means is that our party needs to look at our program, our platform, and other things that we put out through new eyes, if we can move towards eco-socialism, we need to think about changing some of the things that we say and do. And I hope that that's something that I would like to see happen as well. I think that how we talked about changing our state and local, some of our state and locals, which are not very effective. And I think that that's really important. I think that because of the interest in socialism, there is a growing number. So let me start back. There's always been a certain number of socialists in our party. And that number has been growing in recent years. And we need to talk to the eco-socialists, most of whom are not in our party. And we need to move, as our party becomes more popularly identified as an eco-socialist organization, I think that we can bring them in. And we need to bring them in. Our party is aging, frankly. Our party doesn't have as many young people as it ought to. And there are lots of young people who are looking for ways to move forward. Many of them have become, have sort of started with the Democratic Party, but are rapidly finding out that the Democratic Party is not a home for them. And so in order for us to be, we need to revitalize our local and state structures to make them attractive to these people who are looking for an alternative. And I think that could be done, but it's a big job. And I think that the Green Socialist Organizing Project can play a role in that. The other thing I want to talk about is our needs as a party. Howie talked about the voter suppression of the Democratic Party. I think that this is a serious matter. And we need to add that to, when people talk about democratic elections, I think we need to be ready to say something about the way the Democrats have treated us in a number of states. In California, where I live, top two has passed. And what top two did means that almost never do our candidates make it into the general election. So they have a primary election and only the top two candidates, and it could be two Republicans, two Democrats, whatever, get to advance to the general election. And this is not good for our party. And it's yet another form of voter suppression, in my opinion. Howie also started to address the question of these things that are being passed in the state level to suppress the Democrats in Republican-led states, but it's not just there. It's a problem because even the Bernie-crats in a number of states have done absolutely nothing about protecting the rights of our party to exist and to compete. They're totally indifferent to that. And I think that we need to make that case to these young people that are, you know, wedded, or at least not wedded. They are at this point attracted to lesser evilism, and we need to take this up. That lesser evilism is still evil, and that the inconsistencies of even someone like Sanders or AOC are not what we need in a time of crisis. Let me just say a couple of things about California. One of the things that we've done in California, which I wanted people to know about, is we just passed a new preamble to our state platform calling for eco-socialism. It was introduced at our last state meeting, and then went to our online voting system for a broader consensus. And it got it needed two-thirds of a vote to pass, and it got 68% of our online voting process to pass. So now it's the rule. And what I'm hoping is that the process that's started by this will continue, and that we, again, getting back to this question of looking at our party and the way we do things, we need to look at that with new eyes, because of our now public commitment to eco-socialism. And I think also, I think that it's key to bringing in those young people that I was talking about. We need to be a more attractive formation in many places to bring in young people. We've not done a very good job about that. And we need to do better. Last thing I'll just say is, and Howie talked about this somewhat too, and that is the question of the task of the Green Socialist Organizing Project. I think that we need to spread the ideas of eco-socialism in our party. I'm sure that there are many people in our party who've never heard of eco-socialism. And there are people who are, I'm sure, opposed to it. And we need to vigorously engage in this discussion in our party. And I think that we have lots of work to do, and I would encourage people to go to our website, greensocialist1word.net, and look at what we have to say, think about what role that they would like to play in our party, and I hope that people will join us. Thank you. We seem to have lost our moderator.
No, she's moving. She just muted.
Oh.
I think. Yeah, there she is.
Okay. Is now our question and answer portion?
Yep.
Okay. We can take stack if you folks are able to, if you can type stack in the chat. It's easier for me to keep track, but if you are having a problem with that, you can also just raise your hand with the reactions button at the bottom of your screen. Okay, we have Steve Welzer, fellow Jerseyite. Go ahead.
Question for Howie. I noticed that you're able to get published on the Counterpunch site, which is great. I think these days, maybe more people are reading Jacobin. Have you approached them? I think your material would be ideal to appear there. What do you think?
Yeah, we're thinking alike. I just submitted an article to them called Escaping the Left's Electoral Impasse. And the first sentence says, whether you're a socialist who believes in a dirty break, a clean break, or no break from the Democratic Party, we all have an interest in pushing ranked choice voting, and particularly multi-seat ranked choice voting for proportional representation for legislatures in the current period. And then basically this is a democratic rights issue, but given that the Republicans have become an extremist party, it's not just the Greens in the broad progressive spectrum that are getting hurt. It's the progressive Democrats for two reasons. One is, in the absence of an exit option, the corporate Democrats take them for granted. And even within there, you know, they were blaming Bernie Sanders, you know, for splitting the vote. The message when the establishment and all the other candidates lined up behind Biden was, a progressive can't beat this extremist Trump. So we share those problems, even if we have a different evaluation for the Democratic Party. So Jacobin rejected it. It's not the first time they rejected my stuff. They did say they want to set up a panel discussion on this. That was a couple of weeks ago. No follow-up yet, but I will follow up with them after this Green convention. So a shorter version of it is coming out in Tempest, which is a sort of post-ISO, more left than Jacobin group that's relating to DSA. And I'll put the full version, which is about 5,000 words. It's a little long for Jacobin. They didn't say why they rejected it. But I think, yeah, that audience I would like to reach. During the campaign, we really had trouble. You know, we had the progressive pundits all out there saying, first they were saying safe states, and then they migrated to no states. You got to vote for Biden everywhere, even in New York, even though Trump is going to lose by a landslide to stop a coup. And, you know, we would write responses, Angela and I, and the only places that would run them was Counterpunch. Ron Daniels, you know, Black World website ran one of them, Z ran one of them. And LA Progressive ran the first one. But after that, you know, only Counterpunch would run it. Common Dreams and these other broader platforms where the, you know, sign-on letters against our ticket were published would not publish our response. So, you know, we can get in the far left media. Counterpunch is pretty ecumenical, but that sort of left liberal, progressive Democrat, democratic socialist milieu has been tough. Although I have to say post-election, I did a podcast with Ryan Grimm, who's with The Intercept. And I've been getting other, you know, communications from that milieu. Not a flood, but I think your basic point is right. We want to engage those people in a dialogue, but it's frustrating. I mean, just the other day, Kate Aronoff, who's prolific in these times, the New Republic, she's very good on the climate policies. And she knows that, you know, I've been campaigning for a Green New Deal from 2010. I've been on panel discussions with her. She the other day said the Green New Deal got started when Sunrise and AOC went to Pelosi's office in 2018. She knows better. And, you know, Mark Dunley tweeted back at her on my tweet that, you know, better than that. But so that's a challenge. And that's why hopefully, you know, the Green Socialist Organizing Project can get some credibility and gravitas so that these folks have to pay attention to us. Because, you know, somebody like Kate Aronoff, and she's been writing about this, she knows that the Biden and even Thrive agenda proposals, which are basically, you know, the same old throw money at the corporations and try to give them incentives to do the right thing, is not up to the job when it comes to really dealing with climate change. So, you know, I give her props on she's dealing with the international dimensions, the climate debt, as some people, and we criticize Biden's original proposal, which that's how you internationalize the Green New Deal. She gets that. She gets we need public power, but she doesn't get that the Greens are out here talking about that and she won't acknowledge us. So that's a challenge for us.
Okay, next on stack, we have Rick Greenblatt.
Hi, yeah, thanks. Let me briefly introduce myself and motivate a question. So I'm also from California. I was one of the sponsors of that eco-socialism amendment. I was so happy to see it passed. And I also been working at the local level, especially in San Diego, where I live. I've also been involved with the Green Socialist Organizing Project. So I'm asking this as somebody who's been involved with the organizing project. The question that I have is, we need, and when I say we, I mean more generally than just simply the Green Party, we need to build a party based on the working class, in my opinion. And I think that's generally a position that most people who are socialists believe. I think there are some obstacles to doing that exclusively within the Green Party. And I am a Green and I'm working within the Green Party, but most people perceive the Green Party to be an environmentalist party, which we are and which we want to be. But I think that perception creates some obstacles in carrying out our work as eco-socialists, number one. Number two, most people perceive us as being an electoral party. And in fact, we obviously are an electoral party. But I want to at least state the position that I don't think it's enough for us to be simply an electoral party. We also at the same time need to be an activist party. And to some extent we are, but we also need to be seen as an activist party. And what that means is to be out on the streets, to be in demonstrations. For example, in San Diego, we're working with other groups on the left, including DSA and PSL, to organize a march and rally for Medicare for All, which will be one of about 40 around the country next week. So I don't want to spend more time on this, but the question that I have for everybody here is, what do we do in practice to make the transition from where we are now to becoming or creating an eco-socialist working class party? Over.
I can give a brief response on that. That gets back to the deep canvassing, where we go out and talk to people. If our party is in a particular locality, is closer to university based, and not, you know, so we got the well-educated middle class, but we don't have the working class people that are out there. We got to go to those neighborhoods and talk to people. And when I say talk, I don't mean hand them a literature and say, here's the answer. Ask them questions, get them to talk about their issues. I can just tell you from where I live at in Syracuse, I've done a lot of that over the years, and not everybody agrees with my policies. They don't even understand them, but they just appreciate the fact that I've knocked on their door and listened to them. That means so much to people, because the Democrats who have every office in the city, once they get the nomination, they don't have to campaign. The Republicans are the third party in Syracuse. The Greens are the second party. And I run into people all the time and they want to talk about a conversation we had. I've done so much of it that people come to me for constituent services because the counselor, you know, it's hard to get, or they don't know who they are. That's the kind of relationships we got to build. And this is a mostly Black community. I ended up running for the district seat here because on the QT, Democratic committee members, Black people, said, you got to run. Our counselor is not doing the job, because they knew me and knew where I stood. And, you know, so that's part of it. But then you got to stay in touch with those people, get them on a list, email. Some people don't have email. You got to phone them. So they know you care. And then you're right. We got to be activists. So when things are happening, whether we initiate it or somebody else initiates and we come out and support, they got to see us. and that consistency is because the biggest problem getting working class people involved is they're not apathetic, they're alienated. You know, I know lots of people who won't even register to vote. Teamsters that I worked with who, whenever something came out in the news about some issue, and they knew me as an activist, they would come and ask me, well, what do you think? What's going on? They were following politics, but they felt like voting, they didn't want to be suckers to the system because they said it won't change anything. And they had rational reasons for thinking that, you know, the one-party districts we live in. So all I'm saying is this kind of organizing works. And I think if we're going to build, whether a mostly white, green, local that wants to get the Black and Latino communities involved, or we're mostly middle class, want to get the working class involved, or as Michael said, we got the liberal-minded people, but what about these white working class Trump people who voted for Trump because he gave them a phony populist line and they weren't getting anything from Biden? You know, Biden, like Clinton was what was her slogan? I forget right now, but it was like Biden's, you know, let's save our souls, unite the country. And people are saying, I need a job. I need to make enough to pay the bills. And, you know, Trump was making lies, you know, lying about how he'd help them, but at least he was speaking to them. So I think not all those Trumpies, I mean, there's the core of the Trump and the extreme right is the old Dixiecrats. It's that racist streak that's in our history that Michael was talking about. But they're a minority. I think about a third of the Trump vote are people that are lower middle class, working class people that voted for Trump because he thought he'd do something for them. And the Democrats weren't speaking to them. You know, one of the analyses of where our party system is at, Thomas Piketty has put this out there. It's like we have two elites. We have the well-educated elite. That's the Democratic Party. And that's who they speak to. So it's, you know, they're speaking to the people with college degrees, you know, in the suburbs, but not the working class. And then, of course, the Republicans have the business elites that don't want to pay taxes. Nobody's speaking to the working class. So that's an opportunity for us. But I don't think we're going to reach them, you know, through Facebook messages or, you know, handing out flyers. We got to talk to them and get to know them. They need to get to know us because they're so alienated. They need somebody they can trust, and we got to be the people they trust. So that's my thoughts on that problem. But I see Steve Welser's here. He asked me one point in the campaign, why are you talking so much about the workers? And I said, because that's where most of the votes are. They're not voting, but when we do get to elections, that's where we're going to get a lot of votes if we've you know, built those relationships and organized, you know, their grassroots leaders into the party. I mean, that's where we really want to get. So we're a mass party. You know, you read the traditional community organizing stuff, you know, Saul Alinsky says, find the, you know, the natural leader in a community. You know, big mama on the block that knows everything going on and everybody asks her, you know, what's going on. You know, you get those kind of people involved and they bring a lot of people with them. So this gets back to being good organizers, not just mobilizers. You know, Greens are good at showing up. And when groups have demonstrations, they want us, they tell us, because we know we bring some people. But we need to bring more people. We need to expand our base. So, and you know, working class people are, I think, a prime audience because the Democrats and Republicans aren't really speaking to them. Certainly not in a way that those people have a relationship to the leadership of those two parties in their communities.
Okay, next on stack, we have Richard Gomez.
Oops, yes, that is correct, I think. Oh, all right. Come on, here we go. All right, everybody can hear me, right?
Yes.
Oh, good. Well, like I said, my name is Richard Gomez from Fresno, California. And the big question I have is, should we be in more of a crisis mode?
We being the Green Party?
Green Party.
in the sense that Ralph Nader would say, why didn't everybody have that fire in their belly like he does?
Well, that's one explanation, true. The idea is that we have to look at this as we don't have much time. And what we're asking, in a sense, for people to trust us in a way, because as I understand the eco-socialist system, we're talking about literally taking over industry, even if it's for a short time. We're talking about making a stop from going over the ledge. And we can't do this quietly or nicely. So how quietly or nicely can we, or do we have to be a little more assertive?
I think, yeah, we need to be plain spoken in our demands and make them things that the whole political system has to address. One of the things I was saying during the campaign was, as we go into the 2020s, we can win a lot of local offices because money doesn't play such a big role. You go out in the community and knock on doors, people get to know you. And just the fact that you did that, people are gonna vote for you because you should pay attention to them. And we have over 100 elected officials. We should have thousands as we go into the 2020s. But that's how the Republican Party replaced the Whigs over a decade, which is on a fast timeline. They had the crisis over slavery. It's how the Socialist Party and the Greenback Labor Party and the People's Party and the Socialist Party in the post-Civil War and, first 30 years or 35 years of the 20th century build up parties that had representatives in Congress, many state legislatures, thousands of elected officials. Sarah Dillon's putting up Eugene Debs. She's from Terre Haute, Debs' hometown. So that takes time. And what I've concluded since the election is we got to change the rules. That's why I'm saying a strategic priority should be ranked choice voting, particularly for proportional representation through multi-member districts with ranked choice voting, because that opens up the political system to us. And then these ideas we're talking about will have much more cachet. When it's elected officials saying stuff, the media just can't totally ignore them. Well, they can be biased, Sanders was dismissed by the corporate media, even as his vote totals ran up. Then they started attacking him. But hey, it's better to be attacked than ignored. So that gives us a platform and we can answer back. So that's one answer is I think we gotta push hard for changing the electoral system so we don't have this exclusionary single member district, winner take all, plurality voting, which systematically excludes everybody but the plurality or majority in every district. That will open it up a lot more for the Greens and the left. The single member plurality voting, given this extreme Republican Party, is isolating the left. Not just the independent left like the Greens, but the progressive Democrats. That was my argument in that Jacobin submission. So, when I think of urgency, we got to push really hard for these changes in the electoral rules. The other piece is fair ballot access. I think the Green Party should go back. John Conyers had a pretty good bill from 1989 to 1999. And then for fair ballot access, it was called the Fair Elections Act. And it created a federal standard for federal elections, much lower than it is in terms of petition requirements and votes you need to keep a ballot line in the 50 states. It's still higher than most credible democracies around the world, but for us, it's something that would make it a lot easier for us to get on all the ballots. That bill, Ron Paul had a stupid bill that he introduced later, but it was no good. So I think, what the Green Party should do is draft a bill and start shopping it around. So at least we got a piece in Congress we can mobilize around. So those are some of my thoughts on that. But the urgency, you're right. We don't have time to build up like the populists and the socialists did over decades because, this climate change and the arms race and the everyday reason that, our life expectancies are on decline because of this inequality. That's with us right now.
Okay, and next on stack, we have Deborah Sousa Oliveira.
Hi, I have a suggestion. I think we need organizing, canvassing, public outreach, phone banking, public speaking, relationship building, training in each state, and then have like a train the trainer to also empower more leaders to create more leaders in all communities. I feel that's lacking. I don't think people have the skills to do that. So we need to teach them how and what that looks like with somebody that's already done it, so they could shadow them and feel comfortable and then practice that all the time, so they become more comfortable in order to build the strength in each state for each Green Party. I think that's really what's needed, because, like, you know, just talking about it, it's not really moving things forward. We need more action, and we need people getting out in the public, engaging, like at say farmers markets or like art fairs or community events or anything that is going on locally, and building those relationships that are really crucial and necessary to get the Green Party name out there, because I don't think a lot of people know about the Green Party, and they only know the two-party system. So I feel that if we have those trainings and just multiply it in each state, I think that would be really helpful.
I agree with that. We do need to train people. Maybe a first step is to take advantage of some of the training that's being done. I know People's Action did a lot of this deep canvassing in Georgia. The other thing about deep canvassing, it's the best way to persuade voters, as opposed to the flyby canvassing or the advertising or the leaflets. There's a lot of research on that. Because once you got the trust, then you can talk about issues. And, you know, you run into people that think, well, this isn't a good example because most people have been won over, but people have been won over to Medicare for All once they realize it's not government run, and the government telling you who your doctor is. You get to choose your doctor. You know, freedom of choice is a big deal with people. And once they learn that out of these conversations, they become much more supportive. I think one of the most stunning things that came out of the 2020 election was Fox News did an exit poll, and they spun the question to make it against Medicare for All. It was, do you want government run health insurance? 72% said, yes. That's one of those issues. We've won the public, but public opinion hasn't translated into public policy because, well, we know why. You know, leadership in the Democratic Party is bought and paid for by the health insurance and pharma. You know, look at who pays James Clyburn, who's really adamantly opposed to Medicare for All. He's one of the biggest recipients of that industry's money. So, yeah, I think training, and maybe the first thing is to just show up at the people that are doing it. You know, Wellstone Institute, I don't know if they're still around, but I know a lot of Greens learned a lot of campaign stuff by going to one of their sessions. Even though they're oriented to the Democratic Party, a lot of these skills are not really partisan. They're just practical campaign skills. So, but I think the goal should be to have this in-house so we can make it, you know, really oriented to our needs. So I think that's a great idea.
Okay, and next on stack, we have Camila Harris.
Yes, hello everyone. I'm actually new. This is where my background is. I'm actually a new Green. I left the Democrats in November this past year. I did the actual Dem exit and became a Green. I was also in Movement for a People's Party. That didn't work out. So it also caused me to remain Green. So I'm really like focused on like trying to be a part of something that, you know, is legit, is for real. I'm also pretty young. I'm kind of like an old head millennial. So when you guys was talking about the reaching out to the youth, that really, you know, hits home for me. At one point I did attend a historically Black college. And one of the things that I noticed was that we didn't have any independent parties come on our campuses. We didn't have, that angle when it came to like issues and those kind of things being part of our discussions on campuses. And so I was, my question is like kind of like, you know, wondering where the party stands on like expanding into, you know, how deeply do you want to expand into the youth base, if you will? Because I mean, of course, the older millennials, we're pushing 40. That's where we're at right now. And a lot of us are like, you know, kind of, you know, disgruntled. And a lot of us are actually working class because, you know, with colleges, people are coming out of college having hundreds of thousands of dollars of student debt, you know, and, you know, and things like that. So I just wanted to know where the party stood as far as like the issues that are actually hitting our demographics that, you know, that are younger, you know, I mean, even with voter suppression, you know, I think a lot of us, a lot of people in my demographics don't vote for the simple fact that they're not educated in, you know, every day in their communities. I have an interest in voter literacy and education personally, because in my Black community, for example, like nobody's ever heard of the Greens, to be honest. Like nobody has ever seen Greens. There's no Greens in my particular neighborhood, and I'm in Inglewood, California. I mean, nothing independent actually is in my area, the South Bay area. So no Greens, no DSA, no any of that. And so for me, trying to find out where I best fit, I want to know, especially like with the Greens, like how can, you know, the younger demographics, you know, get involved? And also, you know, how can our issues be kind of front and center? I mean, I understand the deep canvassing part, but then also like, you know, through the national board or whoever, you know, making a bully pulpit for the issues that matter to us. You know, how can that happen?
Well, first thing I'd say is that I think Greens are very concerned to address your concerns. We have a capacity problem. You mentioned the national board, we have a steering committee. But we hardly have any staff. We do not have field organizers. So one of the things I've been advocating is that we need to become a mass membership party where people pay dues. So we have, you know, a bigger funding base so we can put organizers. So you're in Englewood. Somebody can come to Englewood and start working with you on organizing and, you know, reaching out to folks. So that's number one. Number two, I want to say that the best response our campaign got this year was from young folks, pre-millennials, people in their early 20s and their teens. I can't tell you how many messages Angela Walker and I got from people that were teenagers saying, please run again, because next time I'll be old enough to vote for you. And a lot of these young people, they could see through the BS from Biden, you know, particularly on a climate issue. On the economic opportunity issues, you mentioned college debt. That's another thing. Biden made a bunch of promises, didn't deliver. And that's, you know, now $1.7 trillion debt, particularly hitting, you know, Black folks more than white folks, because a lot of them went to these, you know, trade school kind of private colleges that were just ripoffs. And federal government didn't protect them from predatory lending. You know, Donald Trump, Trump University, that wasn't the only one out there. So So for, I guess what I'm making an excuse for the Green Party and making a suggestion. We don't have the capacity. We've got to build it so that people like you in Englewood can get help. And, you know, maybe Michael wants to speak to that, being from California, you know, what the California Greens, Mike could do.
I'm not, okay, thank you. I think that there are people in LA that I'd refer you to. If you want to put your email in the chat, I will pass it along to people who are working along our lines in Los Angeles. That's, I live in Northern California, of course. So, we do have friends in Southern California, and I will be happy to put you in touch with them if I can get your email over.
Thank you. I did put it in the chat. Thank you.
And next on stack, we have Mark from South Florida.
Hey, I'm Mark down in South Florida. This might be putting the cart before the horse, but while you were talking about the ineffectiveness of flyering, I was thinking about a possible publication. I know that you put out a lot of stuff, and if we could condense it, and you know, maybe add other people's stuff to it, we could have our own bona fide GSOP, you know, newspaper or newsletter or something. Something I've been disappointed to discover that the Green Party just really doesn't have one, and what little it does have is not like widely distributed. So I thought maybe that would be a good way to get the word out, but. You know, I also thought maybe I was putting the cart before the horse, so I was curious to hear what you had to say.
Well, we've actually discussed that. The Education Committee is working toward a publication which is called Green Socialist Notes. And it'll be a blog at first on the greensocialist.net website. But the goal is to put it into a form that people can download and print out on a periodic basis. So, you know, we have the same concern that you just raised and are trying to address it that way. So if you want to help with that, you know, sign up for Green Socialist Organizing Project on the, you know, cover page of the greensocialist.net and express, you check the box education, and Education Committee will get a hold of you, and then you can help us make that happen.
Okay, and next on stack, we have Frank Lawrence.
Greetings, this is Frank Lawrence from Kansas City, Missouri, Green Party, and state and national as well. I had three quick questions, or first question or statement is on the phone banking, which I do quite a bit of. And I have discovered that you have an untapped resource you need to be working on, and that's your database that exists. It has many names that date back to the Jim Stein campaigns, but nobody's ever called them or emailed them or checked to see whether they're still there. So we would estimate that 3.5 to 6.5% of your own database needs to be called or emailed or contacted in some way, because they are potential members. You can get them signed up with a little bit of effort on your part. I wanted to bring up the idea of a rural strategy for the Green Party. We always talk about the Democrats because frankly, we're kind of like them in many ways. But what we have in this country, if you look at the map, we have little dots of blue, which are the major metropolitan areas of the 50 counties that have about half of the population in them. And then they've conceded the rest of the country to the Republicans. And the Republicans have never done anything for rural people. I mean, they're in sorry shape. I was a traveler for 10 years. I worked around lots of rural counties in many states, and they have lots of needs, and nobody's ever really addressed them. And the only people they ever hear from is like Fox News and the Republicans. So that's the only story they ever hear. So I think the softer target for the Green Party is rural Republicans that tend to run unopposed in rural elections. I mean, if we could pick off anybody and gather votes, I think that's the group that you really should go after. And my last question, since I'm an old man and I've got gray hair and all that stuff, is how does the Green Party do it, you know, in terms of preparing our successors for the job ahead? I think we should be in that mode of how can we find young, energetic, thoughtful people to run for office and lead us into the future. So how do we groom these people and where do we find them? And I have some other ideas on that. I'd be happy to share, but in another mode maybe. So thank you very much.
Well, yeah, I think we underuse our phone lists. We'll go out and do a petition or have a sign-up sheet at a farmer's market. And a lot of times the names on those sheets don't get into a database, or if they do, we don't utilize it. I mean, one thing every local should be doing is sending out about monthly or biweekly, just a short little bulletin about what's going on. And you may not get most people responding or showing up, but they'll appreciate the fact that you care enough to let them know. And sometimes people are, you know, they go through school or and they can't be active. And then things change and they can. So it's worth staying in touch with those people. And yeah, somebody to mute. Whether it's phone banking or emailing or street canvassing, you gotta maintain the lists. Otherwise, you know, they become outdated and then they're not that helpful. I totally agree on the rural strategy. That's part of the, you know, the rural working class, which I would include, you know, working farmers, those that still are farmers, you know, their land's getting bought out by BlackRock and Bill Gates. They're becoming modern day tenant farmers and they're not making ends meet. Suicide and opioid addiction and all that is going up because they call them deaths of despair. And you're right, the Democrats don't have a program for them, they ignore them. I believe the Green Party can be the second party in both rural and urban America because Republicans really aren't competitive in most urban areas and the Democrats in most rural areas, and they don't try. And when the Greens do, we bring issues, shake things up, and we get a lot of votes. And, you know, we're part of the debate and that's half the battle because we can win the debates over time. You know, our Eco-Socialist Green New Deal has a section on, agriculture and rural America. And it does have a program, getting absentee ownership, corporate ownership off the land, getting the land back to working farmers, parity pricing so that for all the commodities, so that whatever a farmer's producing, they cover the cost of production plus a living income, providing subsidies to transition to organic regenerative agriculture, which is a ecological, carbon sequestering process, as well as a healthier way to farm without all those pesticides and herbicides and fertilizers poisoning the land and the people. And so I think we have a real program for people. Plus, part of our emphasis on manufacturing is to bring it back to those regional towns in rural America that processed food and did other manufacturing. All that is something that we can deliver to rural America that the Republicans and Democrats aren't. The Republicans and Vilsack, the guy that Biden brought back, is a corporate agribusiness guy. That's what's screwing rural America. And is really kind of a bipartisan policy, even though the Republicans, you're right. When I was driving around the country, and I turned on the radio, in most of the rural areas, all I could get was Fox, clear channels, you know, 24/7 right-wing talk radio, and evangelical Christian stations, NPR, let alone, you know, ABC, NBC, CBS, the corporate liberal, more liberal media. They weren't there. And so you're right. People are getting one message, and it's not an economic message. It's a cultural message. You know, the immigrants are coming to get you. The Black people are coming to get you, even though there aren't any Black people out there. So I think, you know, that's another vacuum that we can fill. I think that's something we got to work on. And, you know, preparing our successors. Yes, we had a discussion about that in the party building working group of the Green Socialist Organizing Project the other night, where we said the manual on party building has got to cover that. How do you nurture new leadership? I mean, it came in the context of burnout, because some of us do a lot of work, we get older, and finally, or just because we may be younger and we get burned out. And then there's a big vacuum. So we ought to always got to be training our successors so that people can step right up. Whether you get burned out, which we should try not to happen, you know, people need to pace themselves, or you get hit by a truck. You know, we lose somebody, and it's hard to replace. So that needs to be something we need to keep in mind. I think that's a great point as well.
So we are nearing our 150 mark. Do you want to try to grab one more question? Or do you want to
wrap up? Yeah, and I got an announcement at the end, so want to make sure I get that in.
Okay. One quick question?
Sure.
Okay. Next on stack is Austin. Is it Bashur?
Hey, sure, but close enough. No, adding a Y in my name makes me Amish. Hello, Mr. Hawkins. Thank you so much for having this. As you may know, I'm a member of the International Committee of the Green Party US and the Green Party of Korea. The current international relations of the Biden administration are abysmal, to put it lightly. We're nearing almost 300,000 US soldiers around China, attempting regime change in countless leftist Latin American countries and preparing for more wars in the Middle East. In the 2020 parliamentary elections, the Green Party of Korea introduced their version of the Green New Deal, which includes North Korea and rebuilding their economy in a Green New Deal. So with that in mind, how can we be using an eco-socialist Green New Deal to repair broken alliances and fixing the world to be the place we want for future generations?
Well, I think that, first of all, we got to stop the saber rattling and, you know, running warships through the South China Sea. Not that China's all in the right, but imagine they were running warships through the Gulf of Mexico. You know, we are giving the, you know, Chinese nationalism and the repression an excuse to repress and suppress their own national minorities, which are worth being criticized, but you don't do that with military means. I think the carrot of offering development, North Korea is in trouble. We basically got to work with Kim, because the most thing he cares about is staying in power. Not that we can like that, but, you know, helping their people and China. I mean, you know, people say China's got this renewable energy industry. They're also building 700 coal plants to power their Belt and Road Initiative. And they have not committed to peaking their carbon until 2030. So how can we help them do the right thing and have a productive relationship? While we don't approve of their human rights record, we got the arms issue, we got the climate issue, and those are existential for us as well as them. So I think that's the approach we need to take, more carrots than sticks. I haven't seen this South Korean program. I want to look at it. That's interesting. You know, the idea that we have not signed, we only have an armistice with North Korea, not a peace treaty, and we got all those troops over there, war games. You know, Kim may not be a Democrat, small d, but he is understandably worried, and his, you know, ruling class is. So that's not the way, I think, to move the ball forward. So I had to be brief. There's so much to say on the international questions, but, and pushing for regime change, come on now, that's, you know, in Latin America particularly, you know, the U.S. is so hypocritical. You know, they talk human rights, and most people in the world, we're not credible, because we do practice regime change. We got more people in prison in this country than any country in the history of the world. It's the largest prison industrial complex in world history. So, you know, if we want to be credible on human rights, we got to practice it ourselves.
Okay, we are now over time, so we do have to do our wrap up. You had an end announcement, Howie?
Yeah, once again, if you're interested in the Green Socialist Organizing Project, go to greensocialist.net, and on that cover page is a place to sign up, and you'll get notices about what we're doing. We're having our next general membership meeting Sunday, July 25th, 7 p.m. Eastern time. I don't know what that is in South Korea. You can figure it out. And, you know, we'll have more discussion on our next steps there. So I appreciate everybody showing up, and wish we had more time.
Yeah. Thank you very much to our presenters and for our audience. Very engaging. Thanks for the discussion. Enjoy the rest of your workshops.
Thank you for coming to our workshop. This is Michael Rubin. We got power.